Welcome to On Par with Maury Povich. Today on Par, we're joined by a man who has redefined what it means to evolve in media. He was a reporter, he was a hard-hitting news anchor, and now a morning show mainstay. Craig Melvin, a true master of reinvention, if you want to call it, because that's what On Par is all about, finding the moments in life where we kind of reimagine ourselves and show up stronger. So let's tee it up. Good to see you.
I am so excited to be here with you, Maury Povich. Thank you for having me.
I'll tell you, when I started to read about you,
It
was, I mean, there are a lot of similarities between you and me.
Okay.
And we'll start in the beginning.
All right.
Okay? 15 years old and you get a job in TV.
I got lucky. Yeah, I was in Columbia, South Carolina. That's where I grew up. I was watching TV one afternoon. Commercial comes on. They're looking for a high school student to report on news that affects like young people. So you do, you know, you do
at the mall.
Yeah. So I hopped in my dad's 73 Pontiac Le Mans and I drive down to Richland Fashion Mall and I audition and I got picked. I don't think there were a lot of other folks who auditioned, but I got picked and I would do these stories with the producer on like teens and smoking and teens and sex and teens and seatbelt safety and all this stuff.
So you were bit by the business.
At 15, I walked into the local TV newsroom and I saw all these people that I had grown up watching on TV. And I'm like, oh my God, there's Susan Audet, there's Joe Pinner, there's Rick Henry, all these people that I... And they were at their desk, you know, working on scripts and just the energy of it. And just this idea that you could make a living telling stories and asking questions.
I'm the same age in Washington, D.C., where you end up going. We'll talk about that in a minute. And I'm doing the same thing because I'm an assistant to the broadcaster of the Washington Senators baseball team.
Wow.
And I travel all over the country with the team during the summer to all the major league cities. And I'm just bit by this
How
business.
Old were you?
16.
16.
16 to 23 through college I had that job. I meet guys like Ted Williams and Mickey Mantle and all these people. And
wow.
It was just fantastic. Bob Wolf was the broadcaster, Hall of Fame broadcaster. It was great. And I remember learning so much.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So early in life.
I also think, Maury, I've always been a fan of the 10,000-hour rule. And I think if you...
What's that mean?
The 10,000-hour rule. Malcolm Gladwell was the one who introduced it to me. I forget which one of his books. But this idea that if you spend 10,000 hours doing just about anything, golf may be the exception for me. But if you spend 10,000 hours doing anything, you get pretty good at it. And he writes about this band in England that used to play 16-hour sets.
Wow.
And after about 4 or 5 years, they got a big break. The band was the Beatles. Tiger Woods starts playing golf at 2 or 3.
Sure.
Played a lot of golf, got really good. Maury Povich starts at 16. I started 15. And I think it probably helped us more than we fully realized until later.
You know, you talk about Columbia, South Carolina.
Yeah.
I've been to Columbia, South Carolina.
What were you doing there?
Well, first of all, the founder of Wendy's, Dave Thomas, was a friend of mine. And he was a friend because he was very big into adoption.
Yeah.
It was his big deal. And he knew that we had adopted a son. And so Dave and I used to play in his tournaments at Thornblade.
Yes.
In Columbia, South Carolina.
Gosh. So we do have a lot in common.
Yeah. Which brings me to your next stop in the world, Washington, D.C.
Oh, I love D.C.
Did they see you from in Columbia? Because you had worked your way up in Columbia.
It's a great story. It's a great story. So here's how I ended up in D.C. It was 2007, and I had been at the station, my hometown station, where I was an intern. I'd already been there for 6 years, 5 or 6 years, and I bought a house, was dating a girl, was probably going to just stay there and live happily ever after. And I interviewed a guy, a buddy of mine, had quit his job and started working on this guy's campaign. He was a little-known senator from... Illinois, and my buddy was like, there's this guy named Barack Obama, and I think he'd be a great interview for your Sunday public affairs show, which I was hosting, and maybe like a shorter version for the evening news. I'm like, Barack, I've heard about this Obama guy, but I heard his middle name's Hussein. I don't think he's had much of a shot. But sure, let's do the interview. I do this interview with then-Senator Obama, and there was a guy who was in town to do an interview as well, ahead of his Sunday edition of Meet the Press, a guy named Tim Russert. Right. So I do this interview with Senator Obama, and I see Tim Russert, who's working out of the station in Columbia, and he says to me, he's like, oh, that was a pretty good job with Senator Obama. It's a good job with the interview. I was like, oh, my God, it's Tim. Thank you, Mr. Russert. Fast forward, a few months later, I'm on a job interview in D.C. because at this point, the network is sending me to, you know, the O&O, Chicago, New right. York, D.C. And I'm in D.C. I'm in this cafeteria. Not a very nice cafeteria, by the way, 4001 Nebraska Avenue.
I know it well.
Yeah. I'm in the cafeteria. And who's behind me in line? It's Tim Russert. He said, what are you doing here? Right. I said, well, I'm here on a job interview. Yeah. General manager calls me the day after the interview. He's like, Tim Russert called. He said, you're decent. You seem to be pretty decent and that we should hire you. Would you be interested? And I was like, yeah, of course. And that's kind of how it started. That's how I ended up in D.C.
So
how'd you end up?
I was born and raised.
I didn't know that.
In Washington, D.C.
D.C. proper? Like
D.C. proper, Northwest Rock Creek Park country.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So I'll tell you what it's like, born and raised in Washington, D.C. The president of the United States, to us, is the mayor. The Congress is the city council.
Yeah.
That's how we thought of things growing up in Washington. And by the way, I competed against one of the great reporters, anchor people, in Washington. Jim Vance and I go so far back.
Oh.
We started together. Jim, if he was alive today, would have been 83.
Yeah.
I'm 86. We had such respect for each other. And you must have known Jim.
Oh, Maury, not only did I know him, he became a dear friend. He was at our wedding. I eulogized him at his funeral. He was so instrumental in my life, not professionally and personally. The very first time I met Jim Vance, they had brought me into D.C. because he was getting older. I was going to be the guy that replaced him, they right. thought. I go into his office. This is 2008. He's sitting there. Computer's not on. But 30 minutes before the newscast is about to start, doesn't seem like he's really preparing a whole lot. And he's smoking in his office. And I remember thinking, even in 2008, you can't smoke inside. So he's smoking a cigarette. And he said to me, he's like,
those are the days.
He's like, young man, I don't have a lot of time now, but I want to get to know you. I want you to meet me for dinner. Best steakhouse in Washington. All right. It's like, okay. Well, he gives me the address. He's like, meet me between the 6 and 11 o'clock newscast. I told this story at his funeral because he insisted that I tell the story at his funeral. So he slides the address across the desk. I pop it into the Garmin, the GPS on my dashboard. Right. And I drive, and I'm new to the city, but I don't see a steakhouse. I see a somewhat nondescript building with an awning that's jutting out from the front of it, and I see a big guy standing out front. So I walk up to him, and I've got the address. I was like, is this address? And the guy's like, well, yeah. And he's like, are you here for Mr. Vance? I was like, yeah, he told me to meet him here for steak. He's like, oh, we got steak. Takes me inside. Maury, I walk in, 7:30 in the evening. There are probably 3 dozen fully naked women dancing on tables and poles. And there's Vance in the corner. He's got this Cheshire cat grin across his face. I said, Vance, I need this job. Like, you got me, I meet you at a strip club? Like, on a Tuesday afternoon?
That's Jim.
And he's like, I wanted to test you. I wanted to see if you would walk in and turn around or whether you'd sit down and have a steak. I sat down and I had a steak. But that was my very, and by the way, that kicked off what would be just a fantastic 6-7 year relationship. He was good friends with my wife.
Yeah. Who I want to talk about. By the way, more people knew about her than you.
Still.
She was a big star. That's another thing we have in common. I've been Mr. Chung for 40 years.
That's right.
And you were Mr. Zarniak.
Yeah, still
down there in Washington, D.C., Lindsey Zarniak.
Don't you think that's one of the reasons that it's worked for you and Connie so long?
Don't you think?
Absolutely.
I think since we're in the same business, mm-hmm. we understand it.
Yep.
The highs, the lows, mm-hmm. the absences.
Yep.
when you have to go away for a week and a half because you're going to Afghanistan or somewhere?
It's, and for us, it's also, you know, I love sports, not as much as she does, but I've always enjoyed sports. But it's one of those things where if she knows I've got a big interview, she'll say to me, she's like, yeah, well, maybe you want to ask about this. Or sometimes I'm like, sure. I want to ask about this, but can you give me, how would you ask it?
Right.
You've got like a professional counselor that's always in the house. Now, the flip side of that, as you probably know, is sometimes you get the unsolicited feedback,
right?
Which I've come to appreciate more as we've been married. But it's been that part of it, it's been great.
It's a great understanding of what you do.
You know, I didn't even know you were married to Connie Chung until, I mean, I was older than I should have been before I connected the dots. And I found out Maury Povich is married to Connie Chung.
Yeah. A lot of people can't figure it out.
No.
No, neither can we. Anyway, when you were growing up.
Yeah.
There was part of your life that I don't understand whether I could have lived it. You loved your father. Your father was a postal worker in Columbia, South Carolina. But he had his issues.
Yes, he did.
And he was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about the fact that, which I don't understand, you were estranged from your father and living in the same house.
Yes.
How does that happen?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I think it's one of those things that, it was a couple of different things. First of all, he worked third shift. So, I mean, he's going to work oftentimes at 11 o'clock at night and getting up or getting back at, you know, 6, 7 in the morning. And then when he would come home, he would either drink himself into a stupor and pass out, or he would just be asleep. So he was physically present, but not really emotionally present or mentally present. Like, he was there in the house, but I didn't really see him a whole lot because I'm going off to school.
No meals together?
No. We didn't. As a family, we didn't have a lot of meals together because of his work schedule and because, you know, to your point, the addiction, especially later in life, the addiction had really morphed into this thing where, you know, he was rarely sober. And when he was, you didn't really want to be around him. And so that went on for years. And then when I went off to college and would come home, the older I got, the angrier I was at him. Because to be fair, the way we view addiction now as a society, we view it as a disease now.
Yeah. You know, back then.
Yeah, you're weak.
You thought it was a crime.
Yeah. And so it was one of these things where in my 20s, I'm like, come on, Dad, get your stuff together.
But you wrote a book called Pops.
I wrote a book called Pops because through therapy, my therapist helped me realize that I had to forgive my father. Not really for him, but for me. And when we had our first child, I started to view our relationship differently. And this happened at the same time. I started to do more and more stories about addiction. And I saw what he was suffering from. And we had tried interventions and all these things, and nothing worked until one day we got a professional. We sat him down. We did it the proper way. We wrote our letters. And he went off to rehab for 8 weeks. And Maury, this was about a decade ago, he's been clean and sober ever since.
I saw the very teary video when you get the Today Show job. And the whole family is there.
Yeah.
And you're just...
Yeah. And I still get a little emotional thinking about it. Because if you had known where we were 15 years ago, there's no universe in which my father is sitting on that couch congratulating me on a professional achievement. But it's a testament to something else. And this is, I write about this in the book. The book was therapy for me. I wrote it because it was cathartic. And you know, people have bought it and they come up to me and they tell me that it helped them because they have estrangement in their families as well. But it also proved, and it's been proven time and time again in my life, redemption. You can't give up on someone.
Yeah.
And even if you know, year after year, right, they let you down, you keep forgiving them. And eventually, you break through.
Yeah. I used to have a list of guys who really screwed me over in the business.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You kept an enemies list.
Yeah.
I didn't know Maury was dark.
I had this list. I really did.
Who was on the list?
Well, here's the best part about the list. At one point or another, this list, all of them got fired. And I felt sorry for them.
Because you're a good human being.
I felt sorry for them.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I just couldn't hold the grudge. I couldn't. Now, you and your father, that's a whole different situation.
Yeah.
But I understand the forgiveness aspect.
You have to. And you know, what's really been cool, for me at least, is seeing him in this chapter of his life. Because he's retired now.
Right.
He's got grandkids. And he's become the kind of grandfather that I wish he had been as a father, if that makes any sense to you. We're going down to the beach next week. And we do it every year, go down the Hilton Head. And one of the highlights is always seeing him out there fishing with his grandkids or on his bike riding up and down the beach. Because again, 10, 15 years ago, that ain't happening.
Right.
But it's refreshing to see it.
How long have you been married?
Oh gosh, how long have I been married? How long does it feel like I've been married some days?
I'd rather have the feel like. How long?
Some days 2 years, some days 20, but we've been married 14.
Okay.
Best decision I ever made.
In the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I still, you know, I still see hints of this.
Mm-hmm.
Interracial marriage.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, I mean, obviously it's better than it was in the 60s, but no, it's still a thing. It's interesting because just when you think it's not as much of a thing, there's something that reminds you that it's a thing.
Like that senator the other day?
Yeah, there's
who
that.
Who took his words back?
Yeah, there's that, and there's, when you have biracial children, it's still tricky because, you know, and there's been some research that's been done about this, but at some point, most biracial children identify with a race. It just happens, oftentimes, by the way, inadvertently. And so it's like merging cultures and traditions.
So you're 11-year-old and 8-year-old. They're impressionable, right?
Yeah.
So what do they think of themselves? Black and white?
I think he would probably tell you he's black. And I think my daughter would probably tell you she's mixed. But it's and even my 11-year-old son, you know, this came up a few months ago because he's a little darker than she is. And he made some reference to him being like black and Sybil, his sister, maybe not being as black. And I'm like, hey, guys, you know, we're trying to use them as teachable moments. But you don't.
So what did you say?
Well, I said that they were both just as black, which, again, I mean, you know, I haven't read as many parenting books as I probably should. But we're trying to let them sort of discover it on their own. But it's not something you think about on your second date, you know? And it's also, for me...
Well, I must say, D.C.'s a little different.
D.C. was, oh, my gosh, yeah, because there's so many different cultures. And
right.
D.C.'s different.
I mean, D.C., I mean, first of all, when I grew up, 60% black.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, but here's the thing, Mark. South Carolina, where I'm from, you know, I remember when we started dating. You know, and I had not dated, seriously dated.
Did you take her down to South Carolina?
A white woman. Oh, yeah, I had to. She had to meet grandma when grandma was alive.
Was it more distinctive down there?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And, it, you know, it was, and it, Maury, there's also, as you know, there has been for years now, if not generations, this, how do I put it? You know, it's, there is a thing in the black community where it's, oh well, if you know you achieve a certain status or wealth or whatever, and you go out and you get a white woman, and it was talked about growing up.
Really?
Oh yeah, it was not. I won't say frowned upon, but it certainly wasn't. And to be fair, you got to remember that, you know, my grandmothers, both of them, you know, they grew up in the Deep South. Back, we're talking obviously before Jim Crow. Like, their memories of people that look like you weren't so fond.
Right.
So they were naturally suspicious and skeptical of other races. And so, you know, when it became apparent that Lindsay and I were going to get married, I took her down there, and you know, the rest is history. But yeah, it was a little dicey at first. How about you? I mean,
with my wife?
Yeah, but I mean, because back then that was.
It's an interesting story. So, we dated off and on for 7 years, not exclusive. And my parents, it wasn't the fact that she was Chinese; she wasn't Jewish. So that was, so Connie says to my mother and father, can I call you mom? Can I call you dad? And they melt. Aww. And so that's over. So I go to her parents, especially her mother. I said, I've known you a long time, Mrs. Chung. Would you like me to call you mom or Margaret? She says, I prefer you call me Mrs. Chung for the rest of her life. 95 years old, she died.
And you were still calling her Mrs.
Chung. And Mr. Chung. And that's the way it stuck. And yeah. But first of all, my wife had such a great reputation.
Yeah.
I don't think race had anything to do with the fact that she's Chinese and I'm, you know, white.
Yeah.
So now you sit in a chair. I mean, I go back to Dave Garraway sitting in that chair.
Okay? The first one, yeah.
And so... you've got Garraway, you've got Brokaw, you've got Frank McGee, you've got Gumbel, you've got Lauer, you've got Savannah. If you want to talk about shoes.
Yeah. It's when you see them, when you string them all together like that, they're big shoes to fill, Maury. And let me tell you, it's not lost on me. I mean, there are very few institutions left in television. And the Today Show, knock on wood, you know, we're coming up on our 75th birthday. And it's one of those shows that I grew up watching it. I got to have lunch with Brian a few months ago and almost got emotional because he was that guy for me.
Sure.
You look up and you see someone who looks like you in a job that you dreamed about having one day. And then the dream comes true. And it's just like, okay, well, now I've been chasing the car for all these years, and now I can actually get in. Now what? You don't want to be the guy driving the car when you run into something. So it's, you know, I'm just trying to, I'm trying to do what all of the aforementioned did. And it's every morning, inform, entertain, enlighten, and try to bounce between a cooking segment with Martha Stewart to here's what happened in Washington last night and how it could impact your bottom line.
You know, it's interesting. It used to be the big deal in television news were the nightly broadcasts.
Yeah.
But the money is in the morning. And so, therefore, executives look at the morning numbers.
Sure.
Because first of all, it's on for, you know, 3 or 4 hours. And so, therefore, there are more commercials, and every big network has a morning show.
Yeah.
You feel a little tight. You feel
I didn't fully appreciate the pressure until a couple days after that morning that I was announced, and because it's one thing when you're a part of the cast. It's another thing when your name's on the door,
right.
and you don't want to be in the chair when you know
it's not the third hour anymore.
Correct, and the ratings start to dip a little bit, and it's like, well, wait a minute, maybe it's Melvin, maybe it's Melvin. So far, it hasn't happened, thankfully, but I was worried about that. I'll tell you, because you and I have been in the business long enough to know, doesn't matter who you are,
right.
Those numbers start to tank.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, I'm working third shift at the post office.
You know, but the good news is. In a job like yours, and when I was working every day on the talk show, you can always look to tomorrow to do better.
Yes.
And maybe the numbers will be better.
Yes.
If I was on once a week, I'd go nuts.
Same here.
The next 6 days.
Same here.
I'd go crazy.
You've never had soft numbers. Your ratings have always been great.
Yeah, but I mean, if I was on once a week and I think I did a bad job, and I don't know what I would have done for 6 days. I would have gone nuts.
I think guys like us, people like us, we're wired that way. Because I'm the same way. And if I'm not working, like I'm taking a week off next week, that's about as much time off as I can take. After that, I get antsy. Right. I feel like I'm missing something. Yeah. I missed an interview, or, you know, I missed some big major news event. But I think
I've always, as long as I've been in the business, it's always been a daily show.
Always for you.
Always a daily show.
Same here.
Even with whether it was local,
yep,
or national, it was a daily show. It was at least five times a week.
I know you get this all the time, but I grew up, I won't say grow up because I was probably older, but I spent many a morning and afternoon with you. I spent a lot of time, first with the current affair and then with Maury. I mean, it was you really reinvented the game.
The 90s were the golden age of daytime talk.
Come on.
I mean, between me and Oprah and Phil, Geraldo, Jenny Jones,
Ricky
Sally
Lake.
Jesse, Ricky Lake, all that stuff.
Montel.
Yeah.
For me, and I know that we're in this age now where people just love nostalgia so much, but I think back on, first of all, that it'll never happen again.
Not over the air.
No, because the business has just changed in such a dramatic way. But even now, I sometimes think, my God, how do they all peacefully coexist?
I know. It was interesting. I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. So Phil, on the 25th anniversary of his show, mm-hmm, NBC does a primetime special for Phil. And Phil invites all of us, all the talk show hosts,
wow,
to come on and do a skit with him during this primetime skit.
It's like the Avengers.
It should be in the late 90s, I guess. So we all show up in the green room. None of us have a word to say to each other.
Are you serious?
Our egos are so friggin' big.
Are you kidding
we
me?
We just sat there, waited to go on. Nobody's talking to anybody. And I'm saying to myself, we're talk show hosts, and we're so into ourselves, we don't give a shit about anybody
else. That's a little disappointing. Looking back on it, do you wish you had at least?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Who was your least?
I think if Oprah had started it all, we would have been fine. But, you know, I mean.
Did you guys consider yourselves rivals back then?
Sure. But in a collegial way.
Yeah.
Not dog eat dog, only in terms of the numbers.
Yeah.
But if we all existed and we all were on for several years, that means there was huge viewership.
Yeah. I mean, there was such an insatiable appetite for it all.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't think that's changed. I think what's happened is that appetite now is being satiated by these god-awful phones that we all have.
Right.
And, you know, every streaming and TikTok and all that stuff. I mean, people are still getting the content. They're just getting it from different places.
What was it like losing a brother?
It was...
An older brother, by the way.
I felt guilty.
Really?
I felt guilty. And again, I've dealt with this a lot in therapy over the years. You know, my older brother, before he died, we had really become like really good friends. And growing up, we were because
and he was much older than you, right?
Only two years. But we lived separately nearly all of our lives because he was the product of a relationship that my father had before my mom. But we were still brothers, and we spent time together and some holidays, and then we went to the same college. I ran his campaign for Wofford College. I ran his campaign for student body president. He lost. But we had gotten to a really good place. And, you know, he was, you know, he didn't drink. He didn't smoke. He played college football. Meanwhile, you know, I drank. I didn't really smoke a whole lot, but I didn't play any college sports. But he was a Baptist minister. He was a man of great faith, and you know, 39 years old, he gets a diagnosis that, you know, it's late stage colorectal cancer. And we're like, what? We thought it was a mistake, and he'd live for almost 4 years. Here I was. You know, I'd gotten a great new job in D.C. I'd met this beautiful woman, and we'd gotten married, and I moved to New York. I'm working at 30 Rock, and I'm living a pretty good life. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but sometimes you look around, and you've got family members who maybe aren't doing as well.
Right.
And you start to feel a little guilty about it. That's where I was with my brother already before the diagnosis. And then he gets a diagnosis, and it was just one of those things where, you know, and even now sometimes I feel, you know, I just, like, granted, my life hasn't been easy totally, but I've had a good run.
I'd say so.
And it's one of those things where sometimes I feel a little guilty about it. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I understand that. I mean, believe it or not, it was the other way around with me. My brother and my sister did much better than I did for a long time. And, you know, it's interesting. My father always worried about me because money just burned a hole in my pocket. I mean, it didn't matter how much money I was making. It was just gone. gone. And so, I mean, there was a time where I had to borrow money from my brother. There was a time I had to borrow money from my father. And there was a big time when, even when I started, after Connie and I got married, she had to help me pay for my daughter's schooling in college because I didn't have the money at the time, although I was the sole support of them. And so, I mean, I've always leaned on people.
Yeah.
And then when everything was okay with me, it's very interesting. My brother and sister were so happy for me. I mean, they were so excited that they didn't have to worry about me.
Yeah, I could see that.
And so that's the way it was with me. By the way, you do something I've always thought about and never was able to do.
What?
You write a journal.
I do.
Daily journal.
It's usually about 3-4 times a week. And then on the days where I'm not journaling, I do some
How long?
Meditation.
What'd you say?
It depends on the day. It depends on how messed up I am in the head.
I mean, is it a couple of pages?
A couple of pages. And I always end with something that I'm grateful for so that I can start my day in a place of gratitude.
Do you look back?
I don't.
Really?
I don't. I used to, and then I...
So
I,
in other words, you've got books of journals sitting there.
I've already told my friend and my assistant, Bailey, that if I get fired or I get hit by a bus, to get the journals and burn them immediately.
Really?
Because if people read some of the stuff, because I'm very.
You're critical?
Oh yeah, I'm critical of myself. I'm critical of others. Journaling only works if you're honest. See, I think a lot of times people who journal, like, they write as if their grandkids are going to read it, so it's all like, you know, beer and Skittles. I don't know. I go to dark places.
Really?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Is that why you don't read it?
That's exactly why. I don't want to go back and be reminded of the... No, but I have found, Maury, it really does. It helps me with my parenting. It helps me with my wife. It helps me with my job. Some mornings I just...
Does Lindsay look at it?
Oh, God, no. Oh, dear God, Maury. I'd let just about anybody else read it before. No. I think one
day... Do
your
kids know you do it?
No, I think one day I'll tell them, and that, you know, maybe when I'm dead, you know, they can go back and see how messed up Dad was.
You also have another hobby that I can't imagine. You make candles.
Oh, Maury, that's my favorite hobby.
You make candles.
Oh, yeah. So it started, sometimes people are like, did it start during the pandemic? No, this was like a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years now. I was in therapy, and we were talking about hobbies. And, you know, I'm a terrible golfer. I still like to try, but I'm terrible at that despite constant practice. And he's like, well, what do you enjoy? I enjoy lots of things, you know, bourbon and steak and red wine and candles and blah, blah. He's like, candles? He's like, you could make candles. I was like, what do you think? I'm a Luddite? No one makes candles. He's like, actually, Craig, some people do. And so I went on this journey. I watched some YouTube videos and I started making them in my kitchen. And Maury, I just found it to be extremely cathartic. I put a little music on, and it helps me decompress. I didn't fully appreciate until recently the job that I have. It requires so much, not just like in terms of the 3 hours of live television. I'm talking about the mental engagement. like having to be on, having to process, synthesize information as quickly as we do every morning, and to be able to interview a celebrity and then a musician and to go outside on the plaza and shake hands and kiss babies and not miss a beat and not come off like a complete jackass, that takes a toll on you. And I didn't fully appreciate it until a few years ago, so I needed to find a way to escape that just sort of helped me decompress. And candle making has been that. And I go out to my wife put me out into the garage about 6 months ago because it takes.
I was
going to
ask, what do you need to make candles?
You've got to have a good wax. I use a 454-54 coconut soy blend from a company out of North Carolina. It burns clean. You don't want to use paraffin wax. Paraffin's terrible for the environment.
And you burn it how?
Well, you got to have a good wick. So I get my wicks and my wax and my vessels from two or three different companies. But if you've got a wick and you've got a burner and you've got your wax, and I use different fragrances, you got to get your fragrances. And a lot of it's trial and error. Some of my early candles were not great. But now I give them, I should have, dagnabbit, I'm going to send you one. I forgot. I was going to bring you one. But no, I experiment with different fragrances and give them as gifts, and I go out.
So we have candles, you know, on the dining room table every evening.
I'm going to send you a Melvin candle.
Oh, really?
I am. I've got a, what's your fragrance? What do you enjoy?
How would I know?
Do you like lavender, or do you like more masculine fragrances like leather, or I've got an oak moss amber that I think you would like.
Oh, I'm sure I would love.
It's a little masculine. It's a little feminine. It's kind of right there in the middle. but no, it's funny because I just gave Savannah one this morning. I gave her my new jasmine candle. I've got a new scent, a new fragrance that I'm experimenting with. I'm really into it. In fact, I tell people now that when I get fired, that's going to be my backup.
You know, you keep saying that.
Yeah. I've always said it. Because if you expect the worst, you're always surprised.
You ever been fired?
No, not yet. Knock on wood, thank God.
Scared to death of being fired, aren't you?
I am.
And all of us were.
Were you ever fired?
Oh, yeah. Now, let me tell you about it.
Uh-oh.
In terms of you, like me, the biggest fear in our lives, mm-hmm. getting fired.
Yep.
And once I was fired, I figured out what it was that we were fearful of.
What?
It was the feeling that you have when you're fired. It's not the act of. It's the feeling, because you don't know.
You're right.
We're just in the, it's, we don't know. And once you are, then you realize, I haven't lost a digit. I mean, I got everything here.
Yep.
I laid down on the couch. I kept watching newscasts. I'm going, I think I'm as good as these guys.
Yeah.
And you pick yourself up, you get another job. But it's the, I swear to God, it's the feeling.
For me, I think it's also one of those things that I'm so driven that the prospect of public failure,
of course,
scares the hell out of me.
Of course.
And then and then you're embarrassed, and then
there's something in the on social media.
Sure.
There's the announcement.
Sure.
There's all this crap.
Oh yeah. I think it motivates me to do as the best job I can possibly do every day. That's part of my motivation.
Sure.
Just not getting fired. You know. Well, and of course the mortgage as well.
Right.
I almost got fired years ago in local news. I had, this was back, I mean, email had been around, but not like it is now. And someone had sent a nasty email to a buddy of mine, a colleague. And it sent this, some viewer, as viewers tend to do,
right.
It sent an email to my buddy Scott that was critical of him. And he forwards the email to me. And my response to him, in an attempt to help pick himself up, I said two words and an exclamation point, F her.
Right.
Well, Maury, I didn't click reply. I clicked reply all.
Oh, okay.
So the viewer
right.
got the email.
And then complained.
Well, and then it was about 30 minutes later, my station manager at the time, a guy named Jeff Hoffman, we're still friends. He comes barreling around the corner and he's got a piece of paper in his hand and he's waving it as he's approaching me. I'm like, oh, crap. I knew immediately what had happened. And he calls me into his office.
Yeah.
He's like, you know what? I should fire you. And he said, I'm not going to fire you.
Yeah.
And part of the reasoning, I kid you not, part of the reasoning back then was I didn't really make that much money that it would
they
really
weren't saving much.
He was like, let this be a teaching tour. Sure. Let this be a life lesson for you, blah, blah, blah. Right. But if you were making more money, you'd be out in your ass right now.
Yeah. So in honor of your late brother, you have a golf tournament called Bottoms Up.
And by the way, my wife named it, which I thought was pretty funny.
Great name.
You know, the tide of colorectal cancer and of course, the imbibing that goes on at the event. And you know what's funny? You don't know this, Maury. I'm a terrible golfer. The only reason we have a charity golf event is a buddy of mine, Darius Rucker from Hootie and the Blowfish.
I know Darius.
And I was at his charity golf event.
In South Carolina.
Yeah. And we were talking. He's like, you should do something like this. You could raise awareness and money. I'm like, I can't do anything like this. And we're coming up on our fourth year, and we've raised in 4 years, almost $4.5 million.
And oh, wow.
All of the money goes to the Colorectal Cancer Alliance in D.C. But it's 2 days. We have a big concert on Sunday night, and we have a golf tournament. You should come on Monday. You should come play.
When is it?
September 15th. I'll get it. I'll get the information to your people.
Okay. I think I'll be around.
Okay. You heard it here first. Breaking news. Right. And there's some other folks that you'll know there too, but it's, and you know what it's turned into? And I didn't even think about this when we started it. It's also become a community of survivors, of caregivers, of doctors and researchers, like everyone, not everyone, but a lot of the folks who are there for that 2 day period. They've been affected by colorectal cancer. And my family comes in, and what's awesome is seeing my niece and nephew, my older brother's two kids, grow up around this event.
Oh, wow, great.
And when he was fighting toward the end, he made me promise him a couple things. First of all, that we would make sure his kids were okay and got through school, and he wanted me to continue the work that we'd started with advocacy and getting folks to get screened and listening to their bodies and having really awkward and uncomfortable conversations at the dinner table about blood in your stool and abdominal pain and we're moving the needle. There are a lot more people every year getting screened in this country for colorectal cancer.
That's great.
And it's avoidable. That's what a lot of folks don't understand about colorectal cancer, unlike a lot of other cancers. If you go in, 45 is the age for most, unless you have a family history or other underlying issues. 45, you go in, you get screened, they give you get some great propofol, you Ooh, go under.
Every 2 years.
Yes.
Since I was 50.
Did you have a family history or?
No, I had some colitis.
Okay.
And because of that, I get screened every 2 years.
Speaking of, people can Google how old you are, but you're about 80, I'll approximate. You look amazing.
No.
What do you do? What's your secret?
I have no idea.
Are you one of these guys that don't drink wine?
All the time. I drink wine after the Johnny Walker.
Is it your diet? Or are you like a vegetarian?
No. I eat everything.
Is it?
I love meat. I love everything.
You're working out every day. You're on the gym.
No. Twice a week, maybe.
So you're just blessed with good genes.
I don't know. My father died. My father died at 92 the day after he wrote his last column.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So you just.
So and he was fully, I mean, he had heart issues, but I don't know. I'm 86. Who the hell knows?
You're a bullshit.
Yeah.
They told me you were 81, 82. You're 86?
Closer to 87 now.
You need to write a book on just longevity. Because are you taking the supplements? You do all that stuff? You do all the weird IV treatments?
And, no. Nothing.
You know what you've done right now? In this moment, you have convinced me.
You can do it.
Well, no, I'm just going to stop like eating right and working out and doing all that crap. That seems to be a waste of time and energy.
I don't think so. I think what you... Keep with the wine.
Keep with the wine.
Damn right.
I'm going to tell my wife next time. She's like, you've had two glasses.
And if it's bourbon, fine.
Yes, bourbon. I do like a nice bourbon. The brown nectar of the gods, as I call
there
it.
There you go. Yeah. And I even do some Hennessy.
God, man, you really have. This has been
right.
Worth it.
So we're going to have fun with some headlines.
Okay.
Gentlemen, all righty. Well, having two legendary journalists together, we figured we'd have some fun with the headlines.
Okay.
So we've got some topics here.
Okay.
Oh, in other words, you're going to have a topic. We got to submit a New York Post headline.
Exactly. So I'm putting this thing right in the middle. We're going to go best 3 out of 5.
Okay.
Craig, you start us off.
Okay.
Being our guest. Okay.
Okay.
So what you're going to do? You're going to pull a random topic out of the bucket, and then you have 10 seconds to come up with the most compelling headline that you can come up with. Okay. Just something short and sweet.
Okay.
And then we're going to judge it based 3 out of 5. Okay. Just
okay.
A little game.
All right.
Go ahead.
All right. Oh, God. This could get us in trouble here. Let's see.
Okay.
Man sues fast food chain for emotional damage over soggy fries. My headline would be Florida man sues over fries.
Very good. Maury, let's hear your response.
Let me see. TikTok trend. Crying in the rain is the new self-care. What the fuck? Crying in the rain is the new self-care. TikTok
by default, and the timer expired. So that first round goes to Craig.
Okay, all right.
I guess so.
Round two.
Jesus.
All right.
What the fuck?
Golf cart traffic jam causes delay at retirement village. Florida man driving golf cart. I don't know. I got nothing. Hang on. This is harder than it looks. Golf cart traffic jam causes delay at retirement village. Slow down in heaven's waiting room.
That's good. Yeah. Pickleball declared official national sport by Congress. Congress okays pickleball for the nation.
It's pretty good.
I'm going to give that one to Maury.
That's right. 1-1. All right. That was pretty good. And it was also less inflammatory than mine. All right, mine. Oh, wow. I didn't even know this was in here. A Florida town elects dog as honorary member. Florida being Florida.
Very good. All right, I got one last one here. Craig and Maury caught arguing over who the real goat.
Would never happen.
Craig, more goat than Maury. Bullshit.
Round three goes to Maury.
Yeah,
That's why he's the goat. That was pretty good. That was pretty
okay.
Good.
Now we have the 19th hole.
Oh, let's go.
Okay, so we're at the point where you can ask me any question. I have no idea what you're thinking.
All right.
And I'll try and answer.
Alright. Who's your hall pass? Connie said that, you know, you can go out, you can have an evening with another lady.
I haven't even thought about
it. Oh, stop it, Maury.
I really haven't, but at the same time, she's always said, okay, you can do what you want. All I can tell you is I'll get even.
Oh my God!
And that's her line. That's her motto. She says, I'll get it. Do what you want, and I'll get it.
Okay.
So, Menzie, think of that?
You
would be out.
I would be a dead man. And by the way, every now and then there's a headline or some story. I'm just minding my business, and she'll be like, you see that, blah, 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 or something like this. And I'm like, I have done nothing. I've said nothing.
Right.
I'm already being prosecuted, tried, and convicted.
Well, I always said years ago when Connie was working, she would interview the likes of Paul Newman. I went, really?
Uh-huh.
Or Costner. Oh, really? You know, all these good-looking guys.
Yeah.
I was jealous of shit.
Well, Connie should, she should take some solace in knowing that Maury has never even had eyes for another woman.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Good for you.
It's so, but it's been so long. I mean, Christ.
You've been married how long?
Over 40.
40 years.
Yeah.
And you said that you actually got married later in life than most.
Yeah, well, the second time, we didn't get married. I was married four. I had two great daughters. And then I think I was 46 when we got married.
Okay. All right, so he's not going to give me another one. How about favorite food?
Favorite food? I mean, I am such a steak guy. I mean, I love steak.
Yeah, I got to ask you, the more I learn about you, the more surprised I am that you're still alive.
So am I. Bingo.
Oh! Come on!
Bingo.
Don't ever doubt that. It'll never happen again.
Bingo. You like steak?
I love steak. Love a good ribeye.
You know what I read the other day? I read the other day that this guy was talking about health and longevity. He says, I'm telling you right now, eggs and steak are good. They're not bad. How's that?
I think it's also one of those things where if you, you know, you can't eat it every day.
Right.
It's all about moderation.
Yeah.
Look at it. Man, all right. So I'll try to go to the right side there.
Okay. Whatever you want.
Besides golf, what else do you enjoy?
Nothing.
Are you a big reader?
You know, I read a lot. And you know what I like?
What?
Mysteries.
So what?
You like mysteries too?
So do
I. Love mysteries. In fact, you know who Jamie Gandale is?
Sure, she's the witness.
Okay. So Jamie Gandale's husband is Dan Silver.
Yes.
I am such a fan of his mysteries.
I mean,
just is coming out right now.
I'm reading Walter Mosley's.
Oh, Walter Mosley's great.
I'm
Come back in the hole.
Ah!
And you know what I love more than anything else? Was when Denzel did the movie.
Devil in a Blue Dress.
Devil in a Blue Dress. One of the greats.
It's interesting. Oh my gosh. You know, it's interesting. People ask me sometimes. They're like, oh, do you read for knowledge or do you read to escape?
Yeah.
And the older I get, the more I find that I read to escape.
However, I will tell you.
You're a machine.
I will tell you that it took me 3 weeks this summer. And I just finished Mark Twain by Ron Chernow. So good. He's the guy that wrote Hamilton.
Yeah.
He's the guy that wrote George Washington. Well, bingo.
Make sure that one gets in too.
See? And this guy says he was a bad guy.
I'm terrible. This is never.
That's it. We're going to end on that.
Let's do it.
Okay.
I've really enjoyed this.
If you've had as much fun as I did, make sure you subscribe to On Par with Maury Povich on YouTube and tap that little bell so you don't miss a thing. And if you like to listen on the go, we're on Apple, Spotify, everywhere you get your podcast. Hit that follow button. I'll be back with more before you know it. On Par with Me, Maury Povich, is brought to you by Mopo Productions, A Better Life Media, and Radley Studios, with executive producers me, Maury Povich, Holly J. Mirabella, and Christian Thompson. Supervising producer Mike Bournazian, and directed by Mark Leibowitz.